Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, a weekly podcast that gives thoughtful people some perspective and insight on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May Day, May 1st, 2014. Today, we're joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. So, D.R., there are good weeks and there are bad weeks, and this was a good week for climate hawks. And it was a good week because, in a few words, the Supreme Court of the United States basically supported the EPA in its efforts to stop pollution, right? Did you say anything about what happened at the Supreme Court?
Yes, it was a ruling that came down on April the 29th. The case is known as Environmental Protection Agency versus EME Homer City Generation. And in that ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 6-2 decision, reversed a lower court ruling from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, striking down the EPA's cross-state air pollution rule, regulating air pollution that emanates from, among other things, coal-fired power plants. And the Supreme Court, in something of a shocker considering some of the recent rulings on environmental cases, the EPA reversed the lower court's decision, upheld the rule, and basically said it is a sound policy. Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority decision.
And so you just said a whole lot. So let's go back. The whole case stems from the idea that the EPA issued regulations about cross-state air pollution, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And then, go ahead.
Basically, pollution that emanates from certain states that goes into other states and affects the air quality and the public health in those states.
And typically, those states we think of, right, in this context, are sort of Midwestern states that burn coal, and all that stuff drifts over to Connecticut.
That's correct.
And so EPA put these rules up. A lower court, an appellate court or something, overturned those rules, the regulations of the EPA. The lower court overturned those a couple of years ago, right?
That's correct. The Wall Street Journal reported that, quote, the Obama administration's EPA regulation, which was struck down by the D.C. Circuit in 2012, was intended to replace a Bush administration effort that suffered a defeat in the same appeals court. The D.C. Circuit said the Bush-era rule had several flaws. And then the D.C. Circuit, in the ruling that precipitated this Supreme Court ruling, said the EPA's Obama-era approach forced some states to limit more than half of their emissions, and also claimed the EPA didn't give the states a fair crack at coming up with their own plans for reducing emissions. But the Supreme Court, in reversing that decision, made it clear that, again, in Justice Ginsburg's opinion, and Justice Ginsburg's ruling, that the EPA got it right, that again, Lisa Jackson was the head, the EPA administrator at the time, that she got it right in terms of her formulation as to how to implement the cross-state air pollution rule.
Okay, so we're building up. We got the cross-state pollution air pollution rules issued by the EPA. The Fifth District's Court of Appeals rejects it, pushes it down, and then how does it get to the Supreme Court? Did the EPA bring it to the Supreme Court?
Yes, the EPA appealed. Much of the discussion that has occurred stems from the fact that it was in fact a 6-2 ruling. Uh-huh. Usually, these rulings go 5-4, and Justice Samuel Alito recused himself for an as yet unexplained reason. Right. It's still odd as to why he recused himself, but again, to have you know. Sort of that large of a ruling, 6-2, is pretty significant.
So the EPA is taking this rejection from the appellate court, goes to the Supreme Court, makes the case, and says, basically, what do they say to the Supreme Court? I think what they said was that Ohio, Wisconsin, all these sort of Midwestern states, the pollution that comes out of them and blows across New York and Connecticut, for example, the EPA cannot figure out exactly which state contributed how much and where the individual now this is just regular mercury and soot, right? We're not talking mm-hmm. carbon dioxide here. This is just
That's correct.
Pollution. Nobody can figure out exactly where the bad stuff came from, so they can't track mm-hmm. it back and get that individual bad guy in one of the Midwestern states. And so mm-hmm. the EPA said, looks at all the Midwestern states and says, okay, whichever one of you can reduce the carbon most cheaply is the one that gets hit and has to reduce the carbon, right?
Exactly. And
that was the bone of contention. Then the coal industry said, oh, that's unfair. You're making some people do more than others, and it's got to be by state, and et cetera, right?
Exactly. In fact, going again to Justice Ginsburg's ruling, quote, required to balance the possibilities of under control and over control, EPA must have leeway in fulfilling its statutory mandate, unquote. And the Wall Street Journal also noted that that according to Ginsburg, if a state concludes it has been forced to reduce emissions below the relevant threshold, it could file a narrower lawsuit based on a particular grievance instead of seeking the wholesale invalidation of the EPA's effort. So in other words, it's basically the court found that those who were challenging the EPA's cross-state air pollution rule were basically making much ado about nothing and essentially trying to avoid responsibility for pollution, basically.
Well, I mean, the various opinions, we'll get to Justice Scalia's opinion later, but Justice Ginsburg, who wrote the opinion for the majority that approved of the EPA's course of action, she quoted the Bible, right? There's some quotes in the Bible about you don't know where the wind comes, you don't know where it goes, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, she quoted John 3:8, quote, "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the wind, the sound thereof, but canst not tell where it cometh and whither it goeth," unquote.
Nor can you tell where the pollution carried on that wind comes and goes, right?
Exactly.
So what this does is it's a stamp of approval on the EPA's method of controlling this kind of mercury and aerosol soot pollution. Mm-hmm. And now you were talking before, this is a 6-2 decision, right? And so my understanding is Chief Justice Roberts was in the majority this time among the six people, right?
Yes, Roberts and Kennedy joined Breyer, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, obviously, mm-hmm. and Kagan, mm-hmm. and this was seen as significant. Ann Carlson of the website LegalPlanet.org made the point that this is pretty significant because in another famous environmental case, Massachusetts versus EPA, Roberts was in the minority, basically, essentially finding more or less that the EPA did not have the authority to regulate carbon pollution, carbon dioxide from automobiles, whereas Justice Kennedy was in the majority on that case because Justice Kennedy concluded at that time and concluded again this time around that states have the authority to protect public health and to protect themselves from damages to public health by pollutants. So the fact that Justice Roberts also seems to recognize Kennedy's logic is of significance, and it's basically being seen in some quarters as a good sign when inevitably challenges to the EPA's efforts to regulate carbon pollution from power plants are challenged.
Right. Now, that's so what we've just discussed is what this case did. That, I mean, the Supreme Court approved the EPA's method of controlling the pollution. And DR, you just touched on why we are, so, as climate hawks, we are so happy about this, right? By the Supreme Court approves the method, and that method is what is essentially going to be used by the Obama administration to control carbon dioxide, right?
Yes. There's a general sense that the EPA cross-state air pollution rule is sort of a template for how the EPA will regulate carbon dioxide pollution from power plants. And so, if the court, as currently constituted, recognizes the constitutional soundness of the cross-state air pollution rule, they may well recognize the constitutional soundness of efforts to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from power plants as well.
Right, which is when we throw confetti in the air and celebrate, because once the Obama administration rules go into effect, you begin to take a more meaningful cut at reducing the carbon dioxide and global warming pollution. So I think so. And I guess the other interesting thing is that the way the EPA is controlling this kind of pollution is essentially like a cap and trade. Regime. Now, in a cap and trade regime, as you remember, you, as a polluter, as a power company running a power plant, you buy permission to pollute a certain amount of carbon dioxide, and then you can trade that away if you're more efficient than you thought you were, and you didn't need it. And basically, there's a market mechanism. In this instance, the EPA is looking at the cost-effective methods, so that if you have a plant that really cannot reduce very well, and somebody else can do it much more cheaply, that's the way it's done. And I guess that's one of the reasons Justice Ginsburg thought it was such a common sense approach, right?
Yes, again, quoting from Ann Carlson of the Legal Planet site, that Ginsburg basically praised the EPA's approach as a reasonable approach. And obviously, if the court recognizes this as reasonable, that's a good thing going forward. In fact, Carlson's actual quote is, quote, "Ginsburg praised the allocation choices EPA made after recognizing how difficult the choices were. Sensible, equitable, efficient, and making good sense. She then upheld the choices as reasonable, the standard the court uses in assessing an agency's choices where statute is ambiguous as to how the agency should proceed," unquote.
So, if you're out there and you're a climate hawk, you can take a deep breath and smile, because this has been a good thing going forward. We expect the administration to release regulation that will control the construction of new power plants. Right, yeah, that's coming in June. And so
Yes.
those new regulations will probably call for technologies in coal plants that are way too expensive for a coal plant to make any money. In other words, to take the carbon dioxide out of the exhaust stream is so expensive that you just won't build any more coal plants, which is a good thing. And
Yes.
since the EPA's method of sort of apportioning how that can be done has been approved by the Supreme Court, that's a good thing, a very good thing.
Exactly.
So let me go off on one other direction. After we had Justice Ginsburg quote the Bible in her opinion, Justice Scalia did two things, actually. The first one is, in a sense, more minor. He essentially quoted Karl Marx by saying that the EPA's rule was something like take from those who have and give according to the need or something.
Yes, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need.
Right. So already you can read the subtext here that Scalia will find any excuse to object to the regulations, and has this old sort of conservative meme of regulations being socialism and killing the economy. But the more I think, well, all the reporting called it cringeworthy. It turns out that Scalia's opinion on this case that just was released, I guess, 2 days ago, right? He made reference to an opinion from 10 years ago that Scalia himself wrote, and he got the conclusions of his own opinion from 10 years ago exactly oppositely wrong, and that was the basis for his dissent. So
Yes.
he went with this is as if he didn't remember the ruling he made 10 years ago, or he didn't read the ruling that his aide, not his aides, his what do you call him, his assistants wrote for him this time. In either case, it's an embarrassment for Supreme Court justice to be for that to happen. Would you agree?
Yes.
I mean, did you see anything about that?
Yes, and in fact, as it turns out, it was apparently Richard Lazarus, who was a Harvard law professor, that notified the U.S. Supreme Court about Justice Scalia's mistake. Dan Farber, also of the Legal Planet website, noted, quote, Scalia argued in his support of his claim that EPA's interpretation of the provision of the Clean Air Act that governs cross-state air pollution was inconsistent with the plain language of the statute, that EPA was inappropriately attempting to smuggle consideration of cost-benefit analysis into its regulation. He then claimed that EPA had previously tried to smuggle cost-benefit analysis into its attempt to regulate in the 2001 case Whitman versus American Trucking, but the court had made it clear that it could not consider costs in setting national ambient air standards because of the plain language of the statute. The problem with Scalia's argument is that the EPA took the exact opposite position in Whitman than Scalia said the agency did, and as you note, Scalia wrote the majority opinion in that case. So after Richard Lazarus gave him the heads up, they revised the text of the ruling to get the correct citation.
I mean, everybody makes mistakes. So, you know, to err is human. But I think that, I mean, maybe I don't want to get too far out of bounds, but if a climate hawk had made such a mistake, certain parts of the media and our political establishment, their heads would explode in attacking the person. But now we have Scalia who believes that the devil is at work in the world and all this crazy. I mean, you have to start to at least say that this is a very human person. I mean, maybe that's the nicest way to say it. He's a human. He can make mistakes, and you know, the idea that just because he's sitting on the Supreme Court in a black robe doesn't mean he's right all the time. And I don't know, I guess I should stop there because it's not clear to me where I'm going with it. But this guy gets to make incredibly powerful and long-lasting decisions, and he's clearly just faking it. So,
yeah,
I'm not happy.
You do wonder what sort of quality of law clerks they're hiring these days.
Yeah, I don't know. But, well, we don't want to end on that sour note. Let's just remember that the Supreme Court has patted the EPA on the back and say, you go do that, go get that carbon pollution, and it's a very good thing all the way around.
Absolutely.
So another topic that we wanted to touch on this week was just to keep people updated on the divestment effort, I guess, over at Harvard, right? So now divestment, we'll remind everyone, divestment in this sense means big institutions like colleges and universities should sell their stock in fossil fuel companies as a message to the fossil fuel companies, as a moral statement, and also as kind of a economic hatchet to go after the fossil fuel industry. And so many universities have been asked to divest, one of them being Harvard. And what was Harvard's response, DR?
Well, Harvard's response so far is basically to say, you know, hell no, we won't divest, essentially. But earlier this week, students and from my understanding, faculty and past graduates of Harvard University, they engaged in a series of civil disobedience efforts at Harvard University, including blockading the administrative offices in an attempt to urge Harvard Corporation, basically the Harvard governing body, to meet with the members of the group Divest Harvard to, you know, at least have a start a conversation about the need and the moral imperative for Harvard University to divest from the fossil fuel companies that are involved with their $33 billion endowment. And as part of these civil disobedience efforts, one student protester was actually arrested by Harvard University police. He was later released, and charges were not pressed. But still, it's a sort of an effort at hardball by Harvard University, which I guess is feeling the heat and feeling the sort of embarrassment, because as Bill McKibben, himself a Harvard graduate, has noted on a number of occasions, you know, people who go to Harvard University, you know, go there to learn about the need to be a good steward of the world and the need to take responsibility for the world, and to see Harvard abandoning that, to see Harvard not literally practicing what it's preaching, right, is a very, very bad sign.
Well, we Harvard is sort of a marquee kind of contest, right? People would like to get Harvard to divest. There are other places that have divested, smaller colleges that are doing it. It's something that has to be done carefully. For those who don't know, here in Massachusetts, there are bills to try and have the the state workers' pension fund divest its fossil fuel holdings. It's an ongoing effort. We will continue to report on updates. But that's what happened this week. Harvard continues to stamp its feet and say, put his hands over his ears and say, no, I like my fossil fuel. So DR, there's another topic that is floating around out there, and that is, well, we've all heard of the so-called war on Christmas. We know how real that is. We've heard of the war on coal, and that is an extension way beyond reality. But recently, something that's perhaps more real is that there's become a war on solar power, right? Have you heard about that?
Yes, there's been a series of state-level efforts to sabotage the growth of solar power, led by such entities as the American Legislative Exchange Council, Americans for Prosperity, and other groups associated with the notorious libertarian climate deniers, Charles and David Koch.
Right, and the buzzwords there are the Koch brothers and ALEC, right? The American, yes. You said ALEC, American Legislative Executive Council?
American Legislative Exchange Council.
Exchange Council. And those guys, what they do is they write model legislation and then pass it around, and every two-bit state senator and every who wants to put up a crazy bill, he just takes Xeroxes it and brings it up to and puts it in as a bill, right? So that's where these solar power tax things come from.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, earlier this week, the New York Times wrote an extraordinarily strong editorial titled, quote, "The Koch Attack on Solar Energy," in which they noted, quote, "For the last few months, the Kochs and other big polluters have been spending heavily to fight incentives for renewable energy, which have been adopted by most states. Oklahoma lawmakers recently approved one of these sort of solar tax surcharges at the behest of the American Legislative Exchange Council." The Los Angeles Times also reported that the Kochs and ALEC have made similar efforts in other states, so they were beaten back by solar advocates in Kansas, and the surtax was reduced to $5 a month in Arizona. But the big carbon advocates aren't giving up, and they're trying to repeal or freeze Ohio's requirement that 12% of the state's electric power come from renewable sources like solar and wind by 2025.
I just want to put this, to make this more concrete for people. Certainly here in Massachusetts and in many other states, you'll drive around and see solar panels on people's roof, right? The price of solar panels way down. A lot of people like it. It's a way to save money, basically, in addition to saving the planet. So there's a lot more solar panels on the roof. And what these Koch brothers guys have done is to make the claim that because an individual home, a person, has this on their roof, they are costing all the other ratepayers money because everyone has to keep the power lines built, but the person with the solar panels isn't, they're getting power, they're getting that support for free, and they should be made to pay for it. Isn't that the idea? So that individual people who put solar panels on the roof now have to pay some extra to the utility. Because the Koch brothers want to basically scare people away from solar panels.
Exactly, and this is this attack on this concept known as net metering, and the New York Times editorial goes into this quoting. Currently, 43 states require utilities to buy excess power generated by consumers with solar arrays. This practice, known as net metering, essentially runs electric meters backward when power flows from rooftop solar panels into the grid, giving consumers a credit for the power they generate but don't use. The utilities hate this requirement for obvious reasons. A report by the Edison Electric Institute, the lobbying arm of the power industry, says this kind of law will put a squeeze on profitability, and warns that if state incentives are not rolled back, quote, it may be too late to repair the utility business model, unquote.
Right. And I mean, you're chuckling, but that's chuckle worthy. I mean, the fact that we should all be paying extra money to keep the utilities in business when their business model is being attacked, in any other context, these people would be championing the anarchy of the market and how the market was going to, make a better thing. If the utilities had to die and go away, so be it. But when it's their utility or their stocks, all of a sudden it's a different story, right?
Exactly.
I wanted to mention just in passing there, on the GRIST website, and this is now a year or so ago, Dave Roberts put up a bunch of very, I mean, believe it or not, interesting blog posts about utilities. And you would not think that, I mean, utilities typically are pretty boring, but what he was saying was that the utility model, the utility business model, comes from a time in the early part of the 20th century. So we're talking 1910, 1920, when the United States was still trying to provide electrical power, you know, rural electrification, the Tennessee Valley Authority, all these kinds of efforts to get electricity to people. And the simplest way to do that was to grant a monopoly to a utility, which would then have responsibility for putting electric power in throughout a region. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, electric power is everywhere, right? The grid's all in place. Mm-hmm. And now you have this new technology coming along that kind of supersedes the utility, and the utilities are fighting it, right? So their original purpose has been exhausted, and now it's just kind of this zombie thing where the utility's making money and they want to keep making money, and they're unwilling to accommodate the new technologies that have shown up. There was another podcast I heard where the guys were comparing the utilities, the electrical utilities, to a different utility. That is to say, the old telephone, Ma Bell, used to be the utility that gave you your cell phone service, or your landline service, right? But now everyone's got a cell phone, and so the landline becomes less and less valuable, and how that whole business model is crumpling because of mobile phone use. Almost an exact analogy exists for electrical power. The utilities want to force you to buy their power, but if you can make it on your roof, you don't need the utility anymore. And it's really, it's a problem for the utilities. And it was interesting that in this analogy I heard, and this is an issue, as you get more and more people off the grid, then probably the least fortunate have to remain on the grid because they can't afford the solar panels, and so they're going to end up paying higher rates. I don't know. But the idea that we have to put a tax on solar panels to keep the utilities in business is, I think it's craziness.
And when we talk about the Ma Bell comparison, as you know, what led to the breakup of Ma Bell was the revelation that Ma Bell was trying to strangle competition from potential competitors such as MCI. So it's like, you know, it's like those who don't learn from history will be doomed to repeat it. And these big utilities don't understand that you know, this is a short-term strategy. You know, one way or the other, things are going to have to change. And when you see change coming, you either try to take advantage of it, or it rolls over you, one way or the other.
I agree. So we're coming up on, let's see, 27, 28 minutes. There was one other topic that we wanted to get to tonight, and that was sort of the quality of media coverage of climate issues. I mean, we come back and around to this over and over again, but you had a statistic about, DR, you had a statistic about how much media coverage there was of the EPA ruling that we discussed a few minutes ago?
Yes, there was a report earlier this week basically noting that with regard to that EPA ruling, NBC Nightly News didn't cover it at all. ABC World News Tonight didn't cover it at all. Fox Special Report covered it for a few seconds, and CBS Evening News covered it for about 22 seconds. But for a ruling which is so significant, it's such a shame that it got so little coverage, and it dovetails with some, I guess, controversial in some circles remarks that the comedian Bill Maher made on MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes earlier this week, where he talked about the controversy over I guess soon to be former Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, and noting that, you know, if the mainstream media covered issues proportional to their seriousness, that would be covering things like the climate crisis instead of covering you know, Clive and Bundy and Donald Sterling and missing planes and what have you. It's the media's preference for the vacuous and attractive. For the trivial over the terrifying, so to speak.
Right. So in that, if you want to chuckle, we've got a link up on the Facebook page to a bit that John Stewart put up, exactly along the lines of what you're saying, DR, making fun of CNN for this endless coverage of the tragic plane crash, the Malaysia Air plane crash. And he contrasted that to how they spent 4 seconds talking about the IPCC report. So they gave some funny examples of people covering climate change, you know, 24 hours a day, mindlessly looking for things to talk about. But it was funny. So it typical Jon Stewart blue humor, but it was entertaining.
James Earl Jones once said, "This is CNN." These days you can say, "This is CNN."
Oh, goodness. So, look, we can, again, I would tell everyone who's listening to have a, take a deep smile and say that we won a big one this week, and that's good. So the other thing I'd like to tell you is that you can check out the links to most of what we've said here tonight on our blog at massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave a comment there. You can send a comment via email to comment@massclimateaction.net. You can go to our Facebook page. If you go there, you should be able to get to the podcast as well. You can like us. I'm sorry, share us, because that'll send us off to other people. You can listen to us on Stitcher. You can get to us on iTunes, which is, seems so passe nowadays. But anyway, you get to iTunes. And if you do, if you're one of the hundreds of people that does listen to us on iTunes, please subscribe. That's a good thing. You can follow Dr. Tucker on Twitter at Dr. Tucker, right, Dr.?
That's correct.
And so we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much, DR, for being here this week.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone else for listening. We look forward to being back here pretty soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.